thanks everybody for making a little time. I know that you guys are probably excited to get a break. And this idea came up about sitting down, you know, very much in support of, because I think student voice is important. And we're here to serve you guys. And unless we create two-way feedback loops at every level of the system, we might be missing the mark. And we're not a perfect organization, I'll be the first to admit, 9 weeks in. Had a similar conversation this morning over at Grant at Marshall with the leadership team there around ideas they had. I've been having similar conversations with our student delegate around how we elevate student voice. So I just want to start off the bat by kind of underlining that, you know, how do we find effective ways of doing that? And for me as a new superintendent, it'll be important to hear sort of the topics of concern, because how do we get better then? If we're not, we have lots of other data and other things and ways to check whether we're being efficient and our performance is adequate, but the one that matters, I think, the most is the one that the students can provide us. So thanks for making a little time and being here. So I'm all yours. Not sure how you want to format it, but I imagine you have a lot of questions, and I'll do my best to offer some concrete responses, and I'll be honest about saying where maybe I can't offer you a meaningful one right now, because I'm also trying to figure out where we're at, and so it will be helpful for me. I may have some questions to try to understand what you see are the strengths of PPS, and where are the areas, you know, especially as we plan forward for a new school year or even in the second semester, are areas where we could put some energy and some resourcing to kind of make things better. The student experience, that is. How does that sound? All right, well, I'm all yours.
Johnny, go ahead.
My question for you is, what are your plans to expand CTE programs in the district, like the one that we have at Benson with the radio station and shot classes?
Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Thanks
Sorry,
for joining.
We were given the wrong address.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are you from Cleveland?
Franklin.
Okay. Great. Okay. I mean, there are name tags. They don't need to correspond, but...
Well, thanks for joining.
Have a seat.
The more the merrier.
Hi,
how are you?
Good.
Need to apologize. Thanks for making it out here to not a very pretty central office building. The question was, you know, what are my thoughts on CTE, essentially? You know, it's been very du jour to talk about post-secondary college career, and school systems everywhere are having to retool. You know, what do those pathways then look like for the student who's kind of, you know, college prepping and wants to be competitive to whatever college they're interested in? And then at the same time, and there's a lot of students, you know, who want to be prepping themselves to enter industry, you know, of different varieties. As I've come aboard here, and certainly in my experience previous district, where we, you know, really had to vision out what CTE looks like and spent a lot of time building out those pathways, as I've got talking to the business leaders here in Portland, Business Alliance, Chamber of Commerce, you name it, all of the CEOs and presidents, you know, generally have a similar message. We have youth here in the city of Portland. How can the school system best prepare them to be competitive, to be our first hires into our variety of industries? Outdoor retailing, banking, finance, outdoor retail, what health sciences, higher ed, whatever it is. How does the K-12 system, and especially our secondary programming, prepare them to do that? And so some of the things are technically specific in each of those fields, and some of them that they all share in common are what some people call sort of the more soft skill stuff. You might have read in the Business Journal, Portland Business Journal, recently an article about this, but all of the stakeholders out there are very interested in wanting to know how can we engage with the school system to provide those kinds of apprenticeships, summer internship programs. I'm coming from a district where we provided 5,000 summer internship paid, where students would get a chance to see what it's like to work at a local tech company or some other industry and be considered, you know, not the student who comes here every day, but as, you know, a part of the team, part of a project team, where you're seeing, you know, what it looks like to work in a dynamic environment where public presentation of self, product, everything, the expectation, and, you know, make some spending money while you're at it, is something that they're very interested in learning about. We're in the process of reimagining our high schools. We should be building facilities that lend themselves to some of these CTE priorities. And we should be using pathways that match the projections economically. I was having another conversation with somebody about this, so that we're actually, our CTE pathways are preparing you for something in the region, ideally. And especially at Benson, as such, you know, from what I'm learning, you know, such a rich history and legacy around, you know, voc ed in the past, but what does 21st century CTE programming look like as we start to think about the design of that high school? You know, what are the pathways that are going to be the most relevant that could serve, you know, as a hub there that at Benson are going to be critically important? So I don't know if that answers your question around how I imagine what the role of CTE is in the future of the school system, but I think our students should be able to see a portfolio of campuses and see a variety of pathways among all of them that pique their interest, where kids can find their passion. We exist to make sure you have an opportunity to discover your spark, and there should be a place for you to develop it and cultivate that interest. And some of it might be on the high school campus, and some of it we should help reference you to other opportunities. And we should also do that in combination with the higher eds, who also have a different level of capacity to do that, all of which those leaders I've been also chatting with on this topic. And there's a big interest in the state of Oregon to start to move in that direction in the way that many other states have. You see that PPS is starting to, through Measure 98 monies, for instance, begin to make an extra push in CTE programming. So we definitely have a team that's working with our high school principals to think about how do we bolster our effort in CTE pathways in the school system. Yeah? Different topic? Someone? Yes.
So Lincoln has a high school graduation rate of 94% and Roosevelt has a rate of 65%. What is being done to bridge that gap?
Yeah, totally unacceptable, that gap. We, no matter where you attend as a high school, you should have equitable opportunities to be supported and be successful. It is one of the reasons I went into education and have, you know, not because I wanted to ever leave the classroom, but, you know, you start to realize maybe you can make an exponential difference in the outcomes of kids who have been underserved. In PPS, like in almost every other urban high school or urban school system that has gaps in outcomes and performance, the key indicators that people point to is the graduation rate. The first obstacle is how you define it. 4-year, 5-year cohort, modified diplomas, who are you counting in that group? And no matter how you slice and dice it, you're going to find that some high schools are producing greater degree of graduation outcome than others. So you kind of have to ask yourself, if you look at it through an equity lens, what is it that some school communities need to provide additional supports for the student population that they serve? And so there might be, I would never stereotype that every student at Lincoln is a particular profile, because I know that that is not true just from walking around the hallways and talking to some of the kids there. But what do we need to make available in some of the other high schools? It would be wonderful if everybody had a similar graduation rate, and I don't see why, there's no reason that why we can't have those kinds of outcomes be more consistent. And so what is it about, you know, attending a different high school that presents other challenges that where the student may need other supports and interventions? Is there equity in the kind of elective structure? Is there an inconsistency in the supports, the teaching and learning programming? What is it that is accounting for some of that graduation rate difference? The answer to the question is also not just answered from what's happening in the high schools. Mm-hmm. Because as I've done this work, I realize you have to go way upstream. If you look at kindergarten readiness, you will probably notice this exact same high school gap there, right? So, and this is the point at, you know, this is an educational outcome, but when you look at kindergarten readiness or middle school warning indicators or ninth grade warning indicators, you'll note that typically the profile of the student that doesn't have the same foundational skills, you know, didn't get those 0 to 5, doesn't have, you know, perhaps family with all the same sort of opportunities available to them, who maybe didn't have high-quality pre-K, who maybe went to an elementary school that was low-performing, that had instability of teachers, new teachers, instability of principals. They didn't have a high-quality elementary experience, perhaps. And then maybe you saw more of that in the middle school. So You know, the graduation rate is, you know, is one sort of exit indicator. It's kind of, you kind of have to do the autopsy all the way up until that point around how you're going to affect a change to narrow that graduation gap. You can probably do some short-term things that kind of try to tinker with it at the secondary level. Some of the things that have been successful in my previous district are certainly an array of credit earning opportunities so that kids can stay on track. One thing we did in San Francisco is we elevated the graduation requirements even though we had a big graduation rate gap. So we elevated the number of credit requirements, units required, but we also at the same time doubled down on all the supports. So those credit recovery, credit earning options. We did a lot of early college. We had kids who were behind going to community college. So they saw not just, wow, I'm already behind at the end of my freshman year, and now you want me to take night classes in my sophomore year? I can barely keep up. So how do you create opportunities where it's actually doable and realistic? And maybe they see a five-year plan. Maybe they'll get their high school diploma and their AA in that fifth year, and they won't feel like I'm the old kid on campus, but I actually take my afternoon down the street at the community college. I found that that's especially true with a lot of our unaccompanied or immigrant youth. Like, they're showing up in their sophomore year. Of course, they're going to need more time, but you don't want a 22-year-old walking around the high school campus either. They're more likely to drop out because that doesn't feel right either. And so, you know, talking with some of the campus presidents in PCC, for instance, where they do offer some of that dual enrollment opportunity, for instance, I think that's part of the equation as well. And then not all of it is seat time, right? At some point, we'll evolve to sort of a mastery of standard and concept, idea beyond the Carnegie unit in high schools, where you can credit earn through other means. For some kids, a learning platform might be a better way, online, for instance. I'd only advocate for it if there's teacher contact and guidance involved in some online coursework as well. But you want to offer that as an option as well, and that works for a lot of kids. As well, you need to be able to offer an array of opportunities in the summertime, both for kids who want to accelerate into more advanced coursework and also for those kids who need to make up or go back or squeeze into their schedule additional coursework. A lot of our kids also have other things, potentially stacked against them or that much harder. Students with disabilities, they have other support classes, so they're already, finding it very difficult to stay caught up on requirements as well. And then I'm finding, a phenomenon here in Portland Public Schools. You've got a pretty full freshman schedule from what I'm looking at. But then by senior year, I'm noticing a lot of kids don't have a full course load. So what's that about? And how do we how do we make sure that time is sort of well invested for our senior students, especially those that are college bound? Because you can knock out some, and get a head start on some of your GEDs, in college as well, too. So, I need to understand, that scenario a bit more around why, the course load is not spread out a little bit more evenly across the 4 years of high school as well. So there's a bit of an answer to that question.
At Lincoln, one of the big conversation points is the rebuild that's happening, and probably at Benson as well. So what efforts are you making at the district level to make sure that these rebuilds run on budget and on time?
Well, first of all, we're very thankful to the voters of Portland who value public education enough and understand that the environments that you all are learning in and that our educators are working in, that they matter, and that they made a decision, this board, to kind of make sure all our high schools, are the first stage of those campuses mainly, with the exception of a couple of other elementary and middle. But if we have the opportunity and the investment to rebuild our facilities, we should try to be as 21st century about its design as possible. This is why I think that program design process is so important, so that it's flexible enough, model sort of up-to-date thinking about an educational model that creates spaces to support the CTE programming that you want, that takes into consideration things that actually engage kids like athletics and sports and clubs and newspaper and yearbook, that we want to have facilities to support those things too. I've seen other high schools around the country, you know, build in, you know, student centers and multicultural rooms and parent and family rooms. And, you know, how do those things not be seen so much as amenities, but just essential parts of a thriving high school campus? You know, the question at Lincoln or the question at Benson, there are real constraints, right? Like, you can't, so far, part of the bond work is, you know, we do have a team of project managers and people that are trying to be, you know, really judicious and very above board about how we do this, because we have to give confidence to the public that we're being very prudent stewards of public dollars. Like, people are paying property tax money for that. They want to see a beautiful building when they drive by, like at Franklin, and they want to know that, you know, we weren't being superfluous, but we were providing environments that, you know, everybody can be proud of. So we do have to be, you know, careful and wise about those investments while we take into account what are the features of it. And then some of the other constraints are, you know, if you look at Lincoln, it's got this block. Like, where are you going to build? The only way to go is up. And, you know, so you're going to see the flip-flop with the field and building a facility, you know, that's going to support the kind of learning that Lincoln is about. In the same way, Benson has an opportunity to be reimagined for 21st century CTE programming as well. And then from an equity standpoint, as a superintendent, is what is a foundation, a core base of programming that we guarantee no matter what high school you go to? Because it also wouldn't be equitable if one building has all the bells and whistles and then another one had bond work and it's really basic. So how do we make sure that, you know, all of our students are taken care of in their high school experience to receive and be guaranteed a particular campus environment that supports the teaching and learning that we say that we want to be about? So and I know Lincoln in particular is doing quite a bit of work at, certainly your principal is, around sort of looking out in the world around sort of what does modern school design look like? Because, you know, we've been playing school in America a particular way. And it's a Prussian model. It's an egg crate. It's a hallway. It's classrooms left and right. Like, there are a lot of places doing super creative school design that encourage student interaction, presentation. This is why schools incorporate things like black box theaters and other spaces that allow you to, you know, create a community that has all kinds of interesting activity going on. So nothing could be more important besides the educators and the school community than the facility that you're in, you know, creating that kind of experience. Tell me if I'm talking too much in my responses.
No.
Sure.
What has been done or is being done to prevent or prepare for safety concerns at the newly renovated PPS High School, SCOM, including gun violence, earthquakes, and fires?
Yeah. Well, the bond that passed, if I remember how it was titled, it was definitely about health, safety, plus the facilities, right? So as you're probably all familiar more than I am, you couldn't drink from the water faucet because of the concerns. And, you know, one of the first things I inherited on my punch list of chores is make sure that the school system is remediating and ensuring that, you know, my first grade child is going to be okay if she drinks from the water faucet. So that's critically important for us to, you know, maximize the dollars that have been entrusted to us to fix that. And I think that's one of the reasons that the voters did, because anybody would say it's unacceptable for us not to be able to provide safe drinking water. So we're doing 15 schools a month until every school is done by the last day of school. That's sort of our aggressive timeline. And unless we find something, you know, catastrophic that's wrong with the school, like all the pipes need to be replaced, we should be on track. So already a bunch of schools have reopened their drinking fixtures so that kids can drink from the water faucet and parents don't have to worry. And I know PPS has been given a lot of attention for this crisis, but other districts all around us, just from talking from superintendents, realized, well, our buildings are just as old, and we gotta hurry up and test all of our fixtures, or we're going to have the exact same crisis. And I worked in Boston Public Schools for 10 years. Some of those buildings are 200 years old. The first American public school was in Boston Public Schools, and it was just up the hill from where I was a principal. And, you know, you think they have, you know, up-to-date standards to think about, definitely older districts. So that's just the water. You know, I do worry. I thought I was kind of escaping San Francisco in a lot of ways, but one thing that's still a concern here is earthquakes. Right? Like, every day in San Francisco, you feel a tremor, and kids are like, oh, that was about a 2.5. Like, now it's a thing for kids to guess what it falls on the Richter scale, but I've just moved to another active zone. And I know that the city generally, and, you know, joking with the mayor, we talked about this, and even as I meet with, you know, local legislators, look at all these bridges. Look at the infrastructure. Like, some of these are not going to survive, you know, a major earthquake that I think everybody's starting to get nervous about what's going to happen. And as a school superintendent, I have to think about, are the buildings going to hold up so we can get everybody out safe? So as we're renovating and using our bond monies, part of that is, you know, not just the water, it's shoring up the infrastructure so that their earthquake, you know, are going to help us be as safe as possible, you know, when an earthquake hits. It's the ADA so that our, you know, our students with disabilities, adults with disabilities also have access in our new facilities. We got to fix for that. That's bathrooms. That's, you know, a lot of spaces in a building that have to have ramps and everything else. While we're beautifying, renovating classrooms with the technology, the wiring, you know, if you can't run four laptops on the internet, then what's the point? So we have to be fixing for multiple things as part of the design. And the bond's going to be an important vehicle for doing that. But Portland Public Schools is just getting going with that. And coming from a district that passed 15 years, up to $5 billion of bonds, it's almost done renovating every school. So the good thing is we don't have as many schools, and we're getting started now. But, you know, everybody would be very interested in accelerating more schools being renovated at once. Only we have a bond that we have, and we have to wait for the next one to do the next set of schools. And it also tests the capacity of the school system to be running that many projects simultaneously. But we're also feeling an urgency about it, because look at all the cranes. It's hard to find construction companies who can actually come in and do that work. But the longer we wait, the more expensive it gets. And so, you know, there are times in the economy where it's good to be engaged in construction, and the time when it isn't. Yes?
In light of recent investigation into sexual harassment allegations against PPS employees, including Adam Kennebrew and Mitch Whitehurst, how is PPS working to increase support?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really seriously important question. I mean, I was just talking about the health and safety of our students from a water and an earthquake perspective, but the one that I want to be really clear, I have absolutely no tolerance for, is when the behavior of the adults that families are entrusting their kids' safety to is the issue. We've got to have really good process for investigating any concerns, allegations, complaints. We have to be very thorough in our due process and in our investigatory processes of employees where there's concerns like this. Coming into a district that's had, you know, you named two pretty high-profile cases, it's unacceptable, you know, that, you know, and unfortunately it's the case in a lot of cities around the country, but we have to do better and more to assure and protect our students, because there's no place in education for adults that are harming children, and I would say, you know, youth or other adults or their coworkers. And you're all seeing what's going on contemporarily with sexual harassment and with disrespecting people in the workplace. It should be no different in a school system that we be sensitive to those issues, but especially when we're being entrusted by families to take care of kids, we should be doing no harm. And when we hear about it, we should be we should go at it in a very assertive way to look into those. Yes, we gotta respect the employees' due process, but some of these things immediately get elevated, and we should cooperate 110% with the authorities, with social services, with youth services, anybody that is, you know, appropriately should be collaborated with to ensure, you know, any bad apples out there are not in front of kids.
Thank you.
there's been a culture of lack of transparency. Like that led to issues like the lead pipe crisis in 2015. Being just one person, how are you going to combat this culture?
I am one person, and right now I seem to be one of the only people because there's been, you know, I just got here, but I'm inheriting a central office that has had a lot of transition amongst its leadership team. There's been a mutiny over the last couple of years because of the challenges, because of the morale. And, you know, people want to be part of a winning team, and part of it is coming in as a new manager is you want to recruit the best possible team to get you to have a winning season for once, and maybe build those fundamentals so you can get to the playoffs sometime soon. And so sometimes the question of transparency is it that the district is holding back? Maybe. Could we be more transparent and public about the information we do know? For sure. And part of it is that there's just not someone there right now who's managing it in a way that we could be responsive to concerns that, you know, families or questions that they may have. So it's probably a combination of factors. I mean, one early commitment, you know, I made certainly in the interview process and as I spread the message around is we do want to be a school system that's responsive to our constituency, to our client base, students, families, our employees. And we want everybody to be up to date. I mean, this isn't the CIA, you know, so the things that happen here, we want to make sure folks have the best information we can offer. We've tried to set that example this school year as we've opened, you know, with being pretty open about records when there's concerns, for instance. And we just have to kind of gear up better about the communication that every department does in this organization, whether at the school level or in the central office. You know, there's no secret deal making going on around here. It's just, you know, some things are a work in progress. And I think what sometimes, you know, educational leaders feel like is, you know, we'll share with you when we have the final product. And, you know, I think it's better to just be real and say, here's what we got so far. We're still working it out. We actually need more input, and it's a bit of a process. But hopefully that what emerges is best thinking. And I think that kind of leads to the trust issue when you feel like there isn't that transparency, and sometimes people haven't felt like they can share that or say that. So I'll be the first to say when I'm like, I don't know, that's a great question. Here's how much I know about it. Here's what I've discovered so far, and there's probably a lot more that I don't know before I can tell you this is what we're going to do. Because it's a process. So what we can do is try to just make sure that information we do have is accessible, you know, at a minimum up on our homepage, you know, letters to the community or whatever the ways of distributing that information, and that it be accessible, that it be in multiple languages, you know, so all of our families are you know, equitably getting, you know, to know what we're up to as well. You know, that's going to be an ongoing thing that we have to keep continually working on is, okay, there's some things happening. How do we keep everybody up to date?
Do you mind if I jump in?
Sure.
I'd love to add another bit of it. So I'm the media relations director, and I deal with reporters when they call and get them information. But I also oversee the public records request process. So we get a lot of public records requests from the media and from also from private citizens. But we have a commitment to doing the public's business in public. That's our goal. We believe that the public has a right to know what we're doing. So our board meetings are open. The committee meetings for the board meetings are open. The vast majority of materials that are created by the board meetings our public records. So we really have a commitment to getting that out whenever possible. Now, there are some rules. Now, we've gotten some public records requests from the Lincoln Cardinal Times, uh-huh, which is great. So there are some rules, though, that govern what is
sure
accessible. So people have a right to privacy. So for their, like, things that relate to their personnel file, or if they were ever involved in anything that might involve them being disciplined. So we do have exemptions for some of those materials, but honestly, we really do. I used to be a reporter. My coworker Harry Estev, who does a lot of our internal, but there's no real line between internal and external communications anymore. So what we put out, we really believe, as much as possible, we want the public to know what we're doing. And you have a right to know what we're doing, because we're using public dollars to run the school. So believe me, this is a partnership that we have with you, and we're really committed to it. So, you know, I had an interaction with a reporter today where she asked for something, and initially I said, well, that's part of this person's personnel file, so let me check with, you know, we have attorneys who we work with who give us advice, because Oregon has public records laws that tell you what should be public. So in this case, I checked with the lawyer. He said, well, that's part of this person's public record, personnel file. So then I checked back and said, well, we have released other elements of that person, so we want to be consistent. So we're just trying to develop that trust as much as possible. And honestly, whenever possible, we want to get that information out there. So, I mean, it's a commitment that the district has that goes from the superintendent on down with the support of the school board. So right now, we are in the process of revamping our public records policy with an eye towards making things transparent whenever possible. So what's interesting, I think what we're going to see this year, that's going to be a change from years past, there are something like 400 possible exemptions to public records law that you can claim. You can say, well, we don't have to give that out because that's an exemption in public records law. So what we're doing right now as a district is saying, we can withhold it, but will we? Should we? And right now, we want to err whenever possible on getting it out within the law and within the rights of the individual employee. So we really think it's important. So that's one of the reasons you're here now. We want to be open about what we're doing, and we really want to be open with the public about what's happening in the school district. So it's important to me. So, and I know it's important to Guadalupe.
And to our board,
yeah.
As Dave just mentioned. Yes, sir.
So after a letter was written that was shared throughout our school that denied the existence of rape culture, and it was written by a staff member at our school, it sparked a discussion that happened school-wide. It kind of died out, and I was just wondering, is there a plan for education or district-wide discussion around rape culture?
Wow, I wasn't aware of that. You guys were having kind of a great conversation in your leadership class this morning when I was out there, and, you know, that's a great forum to talk about some of these topics, you know, in the same way you guys had others on the agenda. I think we've seen, especially in the last couple of years, you know, never mind all the harassment suits that are going on, and you're seeing what's happening to all these folks that are in positions of authority. We see it at the college level. We see it in fraternities. We see it in athletics. We see it, you know, so everywhere is having to take a critical look at itself in the mirror and admit to the fact that there's some level of a problem. And I would say by extension, we have to also be honest about that at the high school level. And so, you know, I'll always be the first to say part of a whole education should include, you know, health education broadly, you know, that contributes to positive social emotional development of our youth. We have to talk about topics that maybe adults maybe might not be comfortable with, but because they're super important, A, because they just help us become better individuals, have safer, healthier, more positive relationships with one another, but this, especially the issue around harassment or respecting others, that's a problem. And particularly, rape is a very serious topic, and our youth have to be really clear about what consent means and doesn't mean, or looks like or doesn't look like. Particularly teenagers who are, you know, out there dating, etc. You know, these aren't just things happening on campus. you know, we want folks to be engaging in positive relationships, and there should be some sort of kind of parameters and understandings among, you know, the individuals in a relationship, and we would be doing a disservice to kind of sweep it under the rug or pretend that it's not there. So I can't speak to what the culture is specifically in that area at any given high school, but I do know that healthy teenage development at a school level, we should make space for that conversation. Because the last thing I would want is, you know, a school system that is promoting or pretending that that doesn't exist. I think we saw what happened with that on a couple of colleges in the last year or two, and, you know, it all kind of blew up because people were just kind of pretending. So, you know, that happened in the church too, I hate to say. So, and that has required a lot of reconciliation and, you know, critical look at, you know, let's be real about what might be going on here. And make clear that it's unacceptable.
Can we, or could you discuss a little bit about the negotiations with the teachers' union?
Yeah.
It's something that's on a lot of students' mind, a lot of teachers wearing the buttons. And can you give the district perspective on
that? Yeah, we're not as creative to think about what our buttons would say, but I think it would be something like... school systems work when students, families, educators, educational leaders work together in the best interests of students. But this is another area I kind of walked into, 18 months of an unresolved teacher's contract, which is too bad. So we've had a series of mediation sessions because we're at that point in the process of negotiations. When things are not being productive, you kind of move into this mediation phase of things, and that's where I arrived. And so I've been at the table at every one of those sessions, and what I can share is, and the teachers union leadership is sitting in my office right now, and I think our conversations have been productive. We're all feeling optimistic. I'm a very practical person, so I'm like, let's just go article by article, line by line, and talk about these topic areas and what are the things that are important to you guys that, you know, we should consider and prioritize. That makes sense. Let's include language this. That we can't do because for the following reasons, or this one, let's find a compromise. And it's been a very good back and forth, I think. And, you know, it's been, you know, 12, 15 people on their side and a dozen on our side, and you know, and a lot of us are new, and a lot of us have been in negotiations with teachers unions before, and they've been generally pretty positive experiences. So, you know, what I can report out at this point going into the winter break is that, and I think they would say the same, is we believe that soon after the winter break, sometime during the month of January, we should be arriving at hopefully a conceptual agreement and move on to the business of keeping all our focus on teaching and learning. So I'm feeling good about the direction that it's going. The good thing is, as an educator, there's a lot of things that they bring up that are serious that I'm in total agreement about. So the only challenge is, okay, so what's the best course of action to do something about it? And then it's very important to me as superintendent that we be good employers. Because it's good for, you know, we need to respect our professionals. There needs to be employee due process. There need to be protections that we observe. Our principals need to have some bumper rails. They themselves are an important employee group. Yesterday was an example. I met with the teachers union for breakfast, the classified union for lunch, and the principals later in the afternoon. So I know that it's a very important part of my job is to keep those positive working relationships. And I've been having very honest conversations with them around my assessment of the organization. And they're like, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely. I'm like, okay, so if we agree on where we're at and what the reality is, can we together co-construct a strategy for moving this to another positive level of work? And so far, I think there's a commitment to do that. Yes.
What are some of your big main goals that you hope to achieve in this coming new year?
Well, I think I've had a couple of work sessions with the board last week, most recently, around sort of their own expectations for me. I'm their employee. I have 7 bosses. And part of my evaluation is in sort of being clear about what their expectations of me are. So what is evidence of a positive, you know, in this case, you know, 7-8 months of work look like. And a lot of this was in the line of questioning as I was kind of considering the role, or they were considering me as a candidate. And what's become clear at this point in December is there's a few critical priority areas we must and I must put my attention to in order to have, you know, to move the school system forward. The first, we've got to open two new comprehensive middle schools successfully this coming fall, which is not an easy task. We have a building that needs a roof, schools that need to be reconfigured, remodeled, etc. We have a bunch of elementaries that are being reconfigured from K to 8s to K to 5s, so there's a whole enrollment assignment shuffle that's happening that's affecting about 5,000 families. That's about 10% of the school system is going to be somewhere else, relocated. In creating these two middle schools, we displaced other important programs. We have to find homes for them, and you know, that's creating some dilemmas for us because we want to make sure everybody has a quality environment and is well situated. So, you know, the school openings in the fall is the first priority area that, you know, the board and I agree is critical. The second is settle the teacher's contract. So that's the second priority I'm actively engaged in and spending a lot of time on. Third, let's resolve these outstanding personnel issues. Somebody brought up the names of, you know, cases out there, but we've got about 36 active litigation cases right now. That's a lot. You'll notice, you know, I'm rebuilding a team. I have a new interim general counsel. Her and I are working closely on making sure we're clearing the deck on all these legal cases that we both inherited. And some of them have just been kind of hanging out or not making, you know, the kind of accelerated progress that I would want to see. So that's another area. And then the fourth area or goal is to rebuild the school system's organizational leadership. So when I call a cabinet meeting right now, it seems like half the seats are empty sometimes. You know, some of that I created, but I need the kind of team that's going to get us to the playoffs. So one of the things I've been busy doing offline is recruiting candidates to apply to positions we post. And I want the best possible players I can find for the school system. And so, you know, we want to consider candidates both internally that are nuggets of talent who, you know, would be great in a promotional opportunity. And there are people around the country who see the place and state that Portland Public Schools is in and want to lend their leadership. They want to be part of a call to action. There's a lot of people like me that would be very bored to work in just kind of a, you know, on autopilot school system. That's just not me. I operate in a state of change, and some people are uncomfortable with that, but, you know, I would be bored. This is a transformation effort, and there are people out there who want to be part of that kind of collective impact, who are very skilled at it. And so I'm interested in building a team that has good chemistry, that can be transparent, that can be thoughtful, that can be strategic. And that's going to take a little bit of time. The tough part about coming into a school system late in the fall is, you know, most people hire in the late spring for the new school year. And if I'm looking to recruit people, I'm asking them to leave their important positions in other school systems, move their families, their kids out of school, sell their houses. And can you do that in 2 weeks? I mean, I have to be realistic. So you will hear in the next 72 hours, however, an important announcement around my new number two. A deputy superintendent who comes very well regarded and is an exciting, you know, I have to start with my immediate circle of senior leadership, and then we'll keep kind of working our way through the organization to do the kind of, you know, restructuring that is necessary so we have the leadership capacity to take on some of these big issues, whether they're secondary related, elementary related, early education related, SPED related, you name it. They all require leadership that can give thoughtful guidance both internally and to our school communities. So those are the priority areas for this year or the next 7 months. Hi.
Can I go?
Yes.
Great, great. So the closing of Pioneer School would result in Pioneer students moving to Applegate Head Start, including those from the NAIA program, without a new school next year. So if Pioneer closes, what would be done to ensure that Head Start students have a school to attend, and how will PPS compensate for the permanent loss of the room for multiple preschool classrooms?
Yeah, so it's important that I kind of keep repeating sort of the facts. We're committed to doing, you know, several things. One, we have to be about the full continuum of services and supports for our students with disabilities. For some kids, that's push in with support in gen ed classrooms for portions of the day because that's least restrictive for them. For other kids, it's learning center. For other kids, it's substantially separate, self-contained rooms. And for some kids, you know, they've already tried. They need a level of more intensive supports that a general ed setting is not going to be able to provide. And so they need a special school program. And in PPS, that's the Pioneer School. And so we've said, we're not going to narrow the continuum. We need to preserve that option for families. It's not the superintendent's decision around where a student should sit to receive the kind of educational program they need. That's the IEP team's decision to make. And so, but it's true that they're being displaced out of the current current location they're at. And so we've had to do a lot of analysis of our available facilities, which frankly is not a lot, around how do we house the Pioneer School program while also, you know, situating other programs that are being displaced. We've identified a two-campus solution. They're in a two-building situation now. This is would be a lower campus at Applegate and an upper campus at Rice. But we preserve the K-12 seats for Pioneer school program kids who need that kind of a. We have other Pioneer classrooms on other high schools. They're in some of your high schools. There are three high schools right now. We want to add a fourth high school, and we want to gradually keep increasing our capacity to provide those more intensive support needs in a general ed setting, because those kids also want access to some things. And if they can manage it and it's appropriate, then they should have that opportunity too. So what you should see over time is an expansion of Pioneer programming or level of supports, but we're not quite ready for that yet. So in the meantime, we've got to preserve Pioneer School in this two-campus situation. Now, those buildings weren't empty. So in one, there was a central staff at Rice and a success program there that has some students transitioning in and out. That's easily taken care of because those are central people. I'm like, you know, come over here. We'll all jam in here together. But we need the campus because students have to come first. In the other situation, it was Applegate, and that's been operating as a Head Start location, six classrooms, right? So the next task that the team around this table had to look at is, look at the map. Let's look at every available property that we have. It's a little easier to situate, you know, the smaller numbers of kids in places that make sense. One of the things I did in my prior district was add pre-Ks to elementary schools and almost all the elementary schools because they're getting that extra, you know, that extra K readiness push and that opportunity, and they would feed right into the elementary. So it worked. Principals loved it. Parents loved it. It was great wherever you had space. In this case, we've identified it's important to keep a critical mass of those students. These Head Start students, there's about 56 or 60 of them. Half of them are graduating into kindergarten already. So, you know, they're not going to miss anything. But there's about 30 kids who are entitled to another year of Head Start programming. So we have to find a space for those students. So we're doing a couple things. We're moving them in pairs. So two classrooms will go to Vestal Elementary, likely. Two classrooms will go to Kelly, likely. And then that leaves the remaining two classrooms, which serve mainly the native population. And they're a bit more culturally responsive. So even earlier, about an hour ago actually, I was meeting with one of the directors there around this topic because since it's just a pair of classrooms, there's actually a few options and possibilities. So what's important in this case is, you know, what's geographically, you know, makes sense for the families that we serve. How do we keep it connected in an area where that community already is served? So we're going to be talking to them about probably one, two, maybe three options for where the native Head Starts can be located. But, you know, what I've been sharing with the community is wherever you end up, it's going to obviously meet early education standards and regulations. The rooms will be outfitted. And then more importantly, you know, we're moving your home. How do we make sure that, you know, where you end up landing, you know, has all of those features that are important to the native program. So part of what I got to do the groundwork on and the team is to kind of keep connecting with NAIA and the native community around. We're not taking away early education opportunities for your community. In fact, I'd like to discuss how over time, and I wish the state of Oregon would do this as well, how we expand early education. For the same reason we talked about at the beginning, it impacts on graduation and a lot of other readiness issues for our students. And so you should only begin to see an expansion of early ed, not a decrease or a narrowing of those opportunities. I'm also coming from a school district where I was a big Title VI Indian education champion. We had a similar situation where their home kept getting, you know, moved around, and wherever there was space, I actually found them a home, you know, for the long term. So, you know, there's definitely a track record, and I was in charge of early education as well. So, you know, we doubled our number of seats in early education. So just a little bit about my track record, and those are, you know, both early education, Indian education, and special education are big areas on my resume. Good questions today.
Can I ask you one more?
He gets three talking chips and other people haven't talked. If you guys are cool with it.
Anybody who's listening, so at Grant last year, hate speech targeting Japanese students was found, and the administration kind of took the protocol and was covered up and emailed all the parents. But later on, a student of Japanese descent was threatened to be killed after school. And other students were of Japanese descent, didn't want to come to school anymore. Like, they felt unsafe. Yes. So I was wondering if there would be any changes to protocol
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what protocol you're talking about, if this is at the building level. What I was just saying with the teachers union around these student safety and climate issues is I think we need to take a critical look at publishing a refreshed student handbook, rights and responsibilities handbook. I haven't really kind of done, you know, look at where that work is, but and that's just a document. But what I don't think anybody should be in disagreement about is, you know, students should be attending schools where climate and safety should be a guarantee, and there should be no tolerance for hate speech, for harassment, for any of the other things we've talked about. And if you're attending a school where there's a specific subgroup being targeted, like you're mentioning, you know, how does every adult and other peers in that building make it clear we're not going to have a tolerance for it? We're going to be an accepting community. I think you have a principal who, you know, who has that equity mindset, and if there's something that admin team could do additionally to sort of make clear to everybody, we're not going to be about that, and, you know, if you see it, learn of it, see something, say something, here's the way to do that, and then let's call it out. I mean, these are young adults, you know, attending the high school. Everybody can understand, you know, what hate speech is in whatever form it takes, and, you know, the one thing we can do to ensure school communities are safe is when everybody vocalizes at the same time that we're not going to be about that. We're living in a place around the country, and Portland has had its own sort of very public incidents where, you know, that's going too far right now. It really is. And schools should not be a venue where those things are taking place. So if for some reason you feel like that's not being remedied enough, please raise the flag. And if you feel like you're not getting the response you're getting, please bring it to my attention. I would invite you to do that.
Thank you. Can I ask a question?
Sure, Dave.
Oregon is one of the lowest funded states in the country for public education. I'm sure you're all aware of that. How do you do more with less?
Yeah. Yeah, it is true. After Mississippi and California, I think Oregon is the third from the bottom of funding per pupil. Having worked over the last 25 years, you know, 10 years in Massachusetts and the Boston Public Schools, where the per pupil was like astronomically compared to the funding in California, where I also spent 10 years, you really can do more. Money matters. It's not everything. But you really can provide, you know, a different level of educational experience when it's prioritized. And one thing I realized as a superintendent is I kind of can't go out there, you know, with my bowl asking for private investment or with state legislators to say, let's think of, you know, upping the revenue stream until I can, with a straight face, say we're running an efficient shop here. We've maximized every dollar that we have, whether it's external or bond or restricted fund or grant or general fund. You know, we're doing as much as we can with what we have, and there's so many more challenges and priorities, but I don't have the means to really address them in a thoughtful way. And it would be easy to gang up on the school system to say, you know, you're doing a terrible job at that. Well, I mean, I'm trying to make the best meal I can make with the limited ingredients in front of me. And it might not taste good. It might just feed you, but we could prepare a much better dish. And so at some point, all stakeholders, families, parents, students, you know, certainly our employee groups, certainly superintendents around the state that I've been getting to know, we're all facing the same dilemma. There's not enough revenue coming into K-12. I joke with everybody around, it's my new bumper sticker I'm going to print off, 10B for K-12, because right now we're funded at about $8.4 billion. That's inadequate in this state to, you know, by the time you divide it up among all the school systems. We can't do the things that we need to do in early education and supports, interventions, and CTE and enrichments. It's not enough. You add on top of that federal unfunded mandates like special education. It's not okay for the federal government to fund SPED at 11%. IDEA is a federal law. Let's try funding it at 50% for once in history and see what we can do with that. You have school systems that are struggling with real constraints, retirement, PERS funds, SPED, rising costs on wages, etc. It's at some point the ship falls apart because you just can't do it all. You know, try getting a $20 allowance and see how far that's going to get you when you have big ideas for what you want to do this weekend. It's tough to kind of be, you know, within your means and your budget to make it work, and I do think it's going to require a bit of, you know, an elevated dialogue around making public education a bigger investment in this state. So in the meantime, we got to be really prudent about what we invest in, and as I've been saying to the team, there's just some things we're going to have to stop doing. You know, there might be important activities, but they're not a priority right now when you look at all the trade-offs that we have to make, and so some of those are going to be hard decisions, and maybe some won't, because if people can't, you know, describe the through line to student outcomes or their add value, then thank you for your service, is frankly how I feel about it. So, you know, we're coming up on budget development season in the early spring, and the staff has to prepare a budget proposal for the board's consideration, and it's going to have to reflect the priority areas. Or, you know, we're not gonna receive a level of confidence from the public that we're putting our dollars where they need to be.
Thank you, Superintendent Guerrero.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you, guys. And right before your winter break, I mean, the least I can do is make sure you guys leave you a little token, you know that you are here. So we don't give away these pledge pins very often.
Those are
but you
very
guys
prized.
VIPs around here.
Yeah.
Make sure there's enough here.
I think I speak on behalf of all of us that we are very grateful for the opportunity to be here.
And if you ever need to contact me, it's actually a communicator, superintendent. Thank you, guys. Have a good holiday. We'll see you back on your campuses.
I'd like to use your own TDPS mod.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, everybody. Yeah. Keep up the good work. We need fair and objective journalism in this town. And thank you for modeling that.
Yeah.
Thank you.